Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast, interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Wednesday, the 12th of June. Coming up on the program, MK's challenge to the election results. Will a new administration prioritize an education agenda? Why AfriForum is taking the energy regulator to court? The stigma around monkeypox and its implications? And the man who took off his shoes and kept running during the comrades? Let's start with politics, and with hours to go before the announcement of a new government, Jacob Zuma's Umkhonto weSizwe party filing an urgent application at the Constitutional Court to overturn the national and provincial election. So does the case have any merit? I turn now to attorney Modidima Manya, and a warm welcome to you. So do you agree? Is there any merit to this case?
Look, let's probably not even go to the legal merits and just talk about the process. Firstly, you don't expect the Concord to hear a case on 24-hour notice to interdict something that's going to happen on Friday, and you file an application on Wednesday, and that application involves a multiplicity of parties. It involves the state, and you are seeking a relief that prevents the exercise of a constitutional power. You know, just from a procedural point of view, you have a major difficulty. But secondly, you have another procedural problem, that you don't give the court some semblance of what you are relying on to claim irregularities. You just allege rigging, and you say to the court, I am not going to give you the evidence now. Now, you need to at least establish a prima facie case, and a prima facie case is just not an allegation. You need to provide some semblance of evidence. So just on the procedural aspects, I don't even think this case will see the light of day.
So are you suggesting then that this is just a political kite-flying, political expediency as far as the party is concerned?
Look, it might be genuine on their side, not that it's got merit, but people may be genuine to be believing that there's a problem. But you must bear in mind that the court itself is not in a position to determine whether all the procedures are followed unless evidence and information is put before them. Now, MK Party say they've got evidence, but nobody knows what is this evidence except them. And I don't even know whether they know the evidence that they are talking about as well. So they may be having some genuine intention, but not necessarily valid, in the sense that, as you know, the procedure for the elections is quite a watertight process. There's very serious system. Some of them are rigid. You can't even move an inch. They have party agents, for instance, who would have observed in the various polling stations what was happening, which is what other parties did. And that's why other parties are saying we are satisfied. They would have participated in the party liaison committee. There is a procedure to report irregularities and complaints. Now, all those things you have to demonstrate to the court that they don't work for you to even reach a conclusion that there was something unfair about the election.
So if there are key irregularities that are being alleged by the MK party at this juncture, what steps do you think the party should be taking if there is any recourse open to them at all?
Look, in the first place, the IEC issues a timetable of what is going to be done when. And that timetable is discussed with the party, with the political parties through the party liaison committee. And there's a period where you can file your objection. I don't think they met that deadline for filing an objection. Now, if there has to be any interference by the court, there has to be a material irregularity that has got a bearing on the fairness of the election and the outcome of the election. It might as well, Jeremy, that two ballot boxes were lost or were not counted, but would they have an effect, a material effect, on the outcome, even in that polling station or at provincial level or nationally? So I don't necessarily think that this was well thought through, even from a legal strategy point of view. Whether they are busy with a political game, I cannot tell. But if that they are busy with a political game, it's likely to backfire. Because if they lose this case, they will lose face.
Well, that's my next question. If the Constitutional Court, as you're suggesting, chooses either to dismiss the application or simply not hear it at all, what would the political and legal repercussions be for MK and its elected representatives?
Look, the case will not be heard on Thursday, which is probably the date by which it must be heard to interdict what should happen on Friday. So the process of the swearing in of MPs will continue, and the NCOP process on Saturday will continue. Now, Jeremy, this is very important to distinguish. After an election, the IEC declares who are the members of parliament. So the list that has been given to the Chief Justice is the list of members of parliament. The difference now is in the next stage is the swearing in, which is a constitutional requirement for a member of parliament to start performing their duties. So the process on Friday is a functionality process of constituting and getting the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces to start being active. Now, we have a situation where a political party says to the court in their papers, by the way, we have taken a decision to boycott the first sitting of the National Assembly and not to send our members of parliament. In law, we call that a waiver. Within 14 days, if you don't take up your seat, the parliament will inform you that, listen, you are no longer a member of parliament. They will have to send another list. I suspect what should happen, and I'm thinking off the top of my head, that if they ultimately decide they are not going to comply, then it means they have lost the seats, and the seats must be reallocated somewhere or the other in terms of the formula.
Just a final one, and on a broader scale, what does all of this say, this challenge say, about the state of South Africa's democratic institutions and the rule of law? Does it send any kind of message out at all?
Yes, and we must be very worried, Jeremy. Firstly, we must never be tempted to dismiss any complaints that come from any court, regardless of whether we like those people or not. At the same time, we must not be gullible to accept any spurious allegations made against organs of state. Remember, we had this attack on the judiciary. We have had a lot of stories about the judiciary. We know there are political parties which have got an axe to grind with the current Chief Justice. They will have an axe to grind with the next Chief Justice, by the way. But also it tells us that our political parties are not serving the national purpose, the national interest. It's all about them. I mean, if a party has got in its first participation, got such a high number of people voting for it, instead of clapping hands for itself, it's grumbling and complaining and saying, I have been cheated without providing evidence. So this is a problem. But I think where the problem comes with this party in particular is that the majority of the leaders left the ANC supposedly disgruntled as part of a faction. They formed their own party. That very party is now, small and young as it is, now riddled with factionalism. Because as you know, Mr. Khumalo has taken MK Party to the electoral court to reinstate his leadership. He has now been removed from the list. He has also taken MK Party to court to have his name reinstated as a member of parliament. Now, it simply means that the society and the nation will ultimately be a victim of the machinations and conflicts within political parties, which then affects the institutions that support constitutional democracy. If you remember, in Ekurhuleni, there was a challenge to the report of the Auditor General, and there was an attempt to discredit the Auditor General. Now, it seems like at some point, political parties do not want to be held accountable. They start attacking the institutions that support constitutional democracy. The same we have heard about the media, which is the one that tells us about these things that we don't know, that people, when it suits them, they will attack the media. When it suits them, they'll run to the media to try and propagate their own stories.
I'm going to leave it there, and thank you so much for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
I'm going to read in part now from a statement from the Department of Health that says a global outbreak of Mpox disease, formerly known as monkeypox, has been ongoing since 2022. The last time South Africa recording positive cases was in 2022, 5 confirmed then in the Western Cape, KwaZulu-Natal and Limpopo, as well as Gauteng. Well, what is the situation today? The Health Department holding a news briefing, and with me is the Minister, Joe Patla. Minister, welcome and thank you very much for joining us. My understanding is South Africa is one of the countries that is now experiencing an outbreak. What is the position? How serious is it, sir?
Well, we've had 5 new cases, as correctly as you read from the statement. Previously in 2022, we had 5 cases over a prolonged period. We've now had 5 cases in a very short period from early in May, and the last case was last week on the 7th of June. And unfortunately, that last case has passed away, lost his life just 2 days ago on Monday, the 10th. So it's fresh. It's happening now. It's still fairly confined to Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal at this stage. Those are the only 2 provinces with KZN with 3 patients. And then Gauteng with one of the 2 having passed away 2 days ago. So that's where we are in terms of the current outbreak.
Now, my understanding is that the patients that you're talking about, 1, have no travel history, and 2, there are comorbidities, and your department is now working with HIV organizations to implement awareness. What is the position regarding both of those 2 observations?
Well, no, all of them have no travel history. Now, that is an important emphasis because South Africa is not an endemic country in terms of Mpox. In the African continent, West Africa, there's quite prevalence, countries like Nigeria, and then in the more central, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, is an endemic country. So ordinarily, this would have been related with maybe traveling. But all the 5 cases have no travel history. So what it means is that we do have endemic spread, domestic spread. Not endemic, but rather local spread. It's a local transmission. It's not cannot be traced from somebody who had traveled elsewhere. But also that it's all in males, but also that all the 5 are also people living with HIV. So that's the common issue when we talk about the comorbidity amongst all the 5 patients.
Minister, is there any intention at this point to recommend a travel alert?
Not really, because I think one would only say it's a risk fairly confined because the nature of the spread, unlike the spread which is through what you call aerosol or in the air, this is not spread through the air, so it's not something you breathe. You have to be in, not just even in the same proximity, but in physical contact with somebody who has the disease. So in terms of traveling, why it becomes an issue, because we are not an endemic country. If somebody, especially, and again, just to say, without any risk of discriminating, for instance, people who are involved in sex work will be at high risk. And also, as it's been documented, men who have sex with other men are quite at high risk. So especially any kind of those kind of risks in countries which are high risk, but ordinarily one would not even say there's a risk in terms of traveling.
And Minister, at this point, I understand there is no registered treatment for Mpox in South Africa. I know that you are looking at obtaining Mpox vaccines, but they do come at a high cost, do they not?
Well, let's start with the treatment. Yes, we don't, because it's not an endemic infectious disease. And it's very sporadic. We haven't had one for the whole of last year. But even when we had in 2022, it was after many years of never having had a case. So, but there is an approved treatment, which is approved by the World Health Organization, and we have obtained doses of that antiviral treatment, and the patients who have been in hospital have been receiving that treatment. We have an emergency approval by the regulator, SAHPRA. We are also working with SAHPRA and the WHO to get vaccines. At this stage, we are assured by the WHO that they are working with us to approach countries, especially in Europe and the US, where there's some stockpile of these vaccines, which are not regularly used. So we are hoping to actually get donations. And only if they are not enough, then we'll be looking at procurement. At this stage, we have been assured that we are likely to receive donations.
Minister Joe Patla, thank you very much for joining me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Well, let's pivot now from health to education. And while we have rightly been focused on the future of the country's government, some in civil society are asking questions now about future priority, and particularly education, one of our great failings at foundation and also secondary level. I'm going to talk now to Jesse DiCecco, who is a children and women's rights activist. And given that many schools are still lacking basic infrastructure like libraries and laboratories, what immediate actions do you think a new government should prioritize to address those specific deficiencies?
Jeremy, considering the learning outcomes that we're not achieving through our education system, I think making sure that schools have libraries, making sure that schools are not using pit latrines, all the necessary infrastructure that's needed for this, you know, the right to education to become realizable, making sure all those components are actually, you know, prioritized. I think that's the good starting point. We've neglected, you know, the very basics in the education system, things that children need to just get to school, get the education that they require. And I think with the incoming government, they really need to prioritize that if we are going to level the playing field for children in South Africa.
Why do you think issues like this are simply shunted to the margins? There are so many unfulfilled provinces made by previous administrations when it comes to education reform. Why do you think that often just lip service is paid to this entire issue?
Jeremy, you know, I think it's a lack of political will, to be honest with you. We've heard the arguments around issues around funding, but we've seen that, you know, the education department is notorious for irregular and wasteful spending. So that can't be the fallback answer as to why things in the education system aren't being prioritized. So I really think it points to a lack of political will. And maybe because we've neglected these communities, right? We haven't seen, and that's something I mentioned even in the article, that as South Africans, we really need to start seeing fixing the education system as a South African problem. It shouldn't just be something that affects, you know, disadvantaged communities within rural areas or township areas. Those kids' education needs to be something that we too take an interest in.
When you engage with local communities in this respect, is there a growing sense of anger, or have people given up simply and it's now just a matter of despair?
I think both, Jeremy, and I mean my colleagues from centers such as the Equal Education Law Center would be, you know, best to tell us what's actually happening. But I think I've been seeing what is being released lately. There was that 2023 Norms Open letter to say, but we have been crying about the same issues for years now. What more do you want us to do? Equal Education even has like young children, they call them equalizers, who are involved in advocating for their rights towards education. And they're saying they're tired. You know, it can't take so long for government to prioritize these key components to their education. And yeah, civil society has cried itself hoarse. The students involved, the students concerned, have also just cried and have done everything that they can to really get government to focus on these issues. But there's just no will. There's just no will. And it's very disheartening.
Do you think there is a greater role or a different approach that local communities can or should play in either improving the infrastructure or raising the debate in a different way?
Jeremy, like I'm saying, I think for the longest time, and I'm speaking as just someone who is, you know, also far removed, I think for the longest time, we haven't been having enough conversations around what is actually happening, you know, in the education sector. I do think communities have a big role to play in that regard, being involved in those talks, but also putting pressure on, you know, the political leaders that we've elected to say, we've put you in power. This is what you've promised. I mean, a lot of the political parties, even now in the manifestos that we received in 2024, speak to education. They know what the problems are. Even the ANC itself knows what the problems are, right? And they know what is supposed to be done to transform the education sector. So we need to hold them to account. We can't just leave it to leading public interest organizations to do it. And those who are involved, all of us have a role to play in holding the incoming leaders to account when it comes to that, because it's a key sector. Education, if we get education right, we can get a lot of things right in our country. We have a long way, yes, in dismantling what was done under the apartheid government. But I think, you know, the past 30 years, like I said, have been a missed opportunity to really level that playing field for South African children coming from those disadvantaged communities.
There is that old adage that you can't manage something unless you can measure it. Do you have thoughts on how the progress of educational reform should be monitored and then measured to ensure the transparency and accountability from government that you are calling for?
I think we need a monitoring and evaluation, you know, plan. There are suggestions coming from, you know, the norms, and there are various ways in which the education department itself is supposed to track its progress in how it's delivering, you know, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's the output of the education system. But I think we could also just focus a bit more on that. But the issue, Jeremy, I think, is that because we're still dealing, I mean, if every year we have to deal with the delivery of textbooks, school infrastructure, shortage of staff, it really shifts our focus and energy away from looking at what's actually the output of the education system. All that energy that we're using to deal with things that have been settled by the courts years ago could really be going towards looking at what exactly is coming from from the education department. Are our students getting education that's relevant? I mean, we're supposed to be building children that are fit for the 21st century, but we can't even test the quality of the education that's being provided currently because we're focused on all these other unnecessary things in 2024.
And that's where I am going to leave it today. Jesse DiCecco, thank you very much for joining us from the Center for Applied Legal Studies at Wits University.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, let me move now from education to energy, and the lobby group AfriForum is looking to interdict the National Energy Regulator of South Africa from considering municipalities' applications for electricity tariff increases that lack what is termed cost studies. More now from the organization as we welcome Morne Mostert. Mr. Mostert, welcome to you, and maybe a starting point in this conversation is, can you give me examples or data that illustrate how consumers have been adversely affected by increases not based on these cost studies?
Sorry, I missed a part of your question there, but municipalities are required to hand in these cost of supply studies for them to be able to request a tariff increase. So we have received reports of certain municipalities that have done these cost of supply studies, and obviously NASHA may look at those cost studies to give them an electricity tariff increase. But the majority of municipalities in South Africa that are electricity licensees did not hand in these cost of supply studies. And if you look at 7 months back, NASHA's own version was that there was only two municipalities that actually complied with this. So we're looking at the situation where for the past decade, municipalities have only had percentile increases, and percentile increases each year on the foundation where there is no detail to describe what the actual tariff is about. So Currently, we see that NASA is not enforcing legislation to apply pressure on municipalities to do that. And that was a result as well of a court order that was obtained in 2022, giving NASA an additional year to apply this cost of supply methodology, and still they have not done so. So AfriForum is using this application, right, and we want to energize the municipalities to be able to get these studies in place.
Do you have an indication or a handle as to why these costs of studies are not being furnished by the municipalities, and again, what the impact is on the consumer as a result of this?
So the impact on the consumer is very important, because most municipal consumers are paying an amount for electricity, but they don't really know what the inside of that tariff is. What does that tariff represent? Municipalities can't tell you that, and in the most part, NASA can't even explain why that is. And that's a very important strategic move for municipalities, as you cannot go and review this tariff, as there's no basis that you can actually apply to see if it is a rational tariff or not. As to why municipalities are not doing it, I think they have gotten away with not complying with this process for more than 10 years. So why should they start now and start applying it now? It's important to take two letters from NASA into account. In October last year, NASA reminded municipalities that they must comply with the cost of supply studies. But in January this year, the whole story changed, where they said to municipalities, don't worry, just give us these few figures and we will allow a tariff increase. And what we are saying is that this process has already been declared unlawful, but this is not the manner in which the electricity industry can be regulated.
Could you explain to me how difficult it is to compile and source this cost of supply study?
Well, I think if you have certain information readily available, I don't think it takes that long to compile it. For instance, if you do know what are your infrastructure, where it is, how many kilometers it is, what the financials are to replace some of those infrastructure, then I don't think it is the most difficult sourcing to do. But if your municipality has not held records on what infrastructure it has, what developments it are proposed to do in the future, and the mechanisms that are in place to ensure that you maintain these infrastructure. Mm. If those information, if you don't have that, those details makes it very difficult for you to
right.
do so.
All right. Morne Mostert from AfriForum, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And to end our program, a story that I hope is going to inspire you. A Comrades Marathon runner putting his resilience to real test after he ran the majority of the race's second half, and wait for it, without shoes. I'm going to introduce you now to Manda Hadzi. Manda, welcome to you. Thank you very much for joining us. Why did you make this decision?
Afternoon, Tremi. The decision that I made to continue running Comrades, most part of the second half without shoes, is that Comrades on its own takes more months to prepare for it. So for me, those 6 months of preparing towards Comrades and the shoes then now giving me some problems and some pain, I just felt like I just need to keep going in order to finish the race and not have the DNF under my name just because of what my shoes is giving me problems. Mm. So to me, it was more about, you have put in some more work towards this, you can't quit now.
And that DNF, of course, is the worst thing for runners, standing for did not finish. So how many kilometers did you run in your socks?
Probably around 40. The first 10 I ran with only just the socks, up until I get to my employer support crew that was on the road. Then I managed to bandage my feet and the socks. Then I continue with that.
What did your feet look like at the end of the race?
Luckily, I had no blisters. I was expecting the worst. It was just the pain, but I had no blisters, nothing at all.
And how do your feet feel now?
Now, they are way much better. I can step down. I can walk properly. Yeah, I think I'm very lucky to still be able to walk properly after what I can now see as the madness that I've put my feet on the day.
And Manda, when you took your shoes off during the race, what did other runners say to you?
Those that managed to notice, they were asking questions, why? And my answer to them was very simple, was that, guys, this is comrades. We prepare for long to just come in here. I just want to finish this race. Let it be it with my feet or without my shoes on. I just want to get to the finish line. And it really, at some point, it didn't really click what I was doing up until I was left with 3 kilometers to go. I nearly shed some tears thinking of what I am about to achieve without my shoes.
And when you crossed the line, how did you feel?
I was overwhelmed. I won't lie. If there is a video or something of that sort, I was walking and praying on that grass towards the finish. I think I didn't run much. I managed to just run 50 meters. The rest, I was just praying to say, thank God, I'm here now.
And what was your eventual time?
It was around 11:50.
So you made it in time, and that is the most important part of the story. Manda Hadzi, thank you very much indeed, and we certainly salute you for that effort. It really is quite astonishing. Just before I bid you farewell, on our last online poll, I asked you about the economic impact of a government of national unity and also the MK Party deciding to boycott the new parliamentary sitting on Friday. I asked if this was of concern, no issue at all, or sign of things to come, and an interesting split between a portent of the political future and no concern at all. And today, as you heard us reporting in our lead story, the MK Party now challenging the election results. I'd like to know if you have a view on that. Is it a test for democracy? Is it just a spurious case, or again, a sign of things to come? You can share your thoughts on our X and LinkedIn pages. MoneyWeb at midday. We're live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.